Chapter 2. A Step Down a Wayward Path.
Better you than me, Lord Harwick said.
He picked up Brannis's bishop and set his knight down in its place,
accepting the trade Brannis had left open to him.
The Emperor bothers me enough with that nonsense. I would teach him the game, but I fear he does not have the wits for it.
I would not be so certain of that, Brannis replied. He took Lord Harwick's knight with one of his pawns. The move required no thought. Brannis had his response planned out well in advance of his opponent's play. He used it as a pretense to talk to me in private about his choice for Empress.
Ah, so that explains what your little disagreement was about, Lord Harwick said, not looking up from the board.
Brannis could tell by the movement of the Lord's pipe that he smiled beneath the contemplative hand that obscured his mouth.
What do you mean? Who says we disagreed? Brannis asked.
His eyes sprang wider for a moment and his breath caught in his throat. He had counted on the throne room's wards to keep his conversation with Somic private.
Oh, someone just happened to mention to me that the Emperor's collar seemed a bit ripped after his talk with your twin. How many else took note of it, I know not, but I keep good eyes in my pay. They are well rewarded for noticing such details.
Lord Harwick's hand moved for a pawn, but he withdrew it, choosing another in its place.
It was a misunderstanding, Brannis explained. There were no hard feelings by the end of our conversation.
Oh, on your side, perhaps. But if the Emperor is any sort of nobleman, he will hold a grudge. They've all got little ledgers tucked away in their heads of who crossed them, Lord Harwick warned.
Puppet or not, Rashaan is propping him up.
Somic's father was too infirm to make a trip to Cadrus, or he might have been crowned instead. I do not relish the thought of a crusty old thing like him being next in line for succession.
He is 8 winters younger than you, Uncle, Brannis said, smiling.
Sorcerer years, my boy. My body is half the age of his, Lord Harwick replied, bristling. He looked somewhat older than his twin Caladrius, but nothing close to his 72 years. His own unnatural youth he could at least attribute to clean living and good pedigree, but Caladrius looked little more than half his winters, clearly not a work of nature.
Anyway, I suppose I might as well tell you. He has designs on marrying into the family.
What? Lord Harwick asked, incredulous. His attention was now fully removed from the chessboard.
You cannot mean our family. Setting aside for a moment the fool notion that he could arrange his way into having ether-strong heirs, there is no one to be had. You have a second cousin, I believe, on your mother's side. Cannot recall the girl's name, but I think she's at the academy, right? He means Aloysia.
Lord Harwick burst out laughing. He had to take the pipe from his mouth before it fell out.
It may be ill-conceived, but I fail to find it funny, Brannis said, confused by his uncle's mirth.
That is because you still have damned fool romantic notions about love. You got betrothed to your little sweetheart and it all seemed roses and honey. Later complications aside, Lord Harwick added to forestall Brannis's objections about how well his betrothal had gone.
Not Aloysia. She and Joran Destrier hated each other when they were children. You were probably a bit too young to recall the tantrum she had when she discovered they were arranged to be married. We made them go through with it. They got past the point of staring daggers at one another, but never warmed to married life together.
It almost sounds as if she might welcome a change, Brannis said, trying to sound optimistic. He had never before been privy to his sister's marital problems.
Not that I plan to do anything of the sort, but Somic asked for my help in arranging it.
He seemed to think I had done something similar for my own benefit.
Oh, he has these great ominous plans in his head, but our Somic is still an axe-handed idiot. Even a fair number of his supporters within the circle might prefer him dead, rather than see a dynasty of sorcerers from a single bloodline. If he thinks you would have gotten Nyrodan killed for your own ends, he must not have seen the pyre at the memorial, Lord Harwick said. And since he was standing not a spit's distance from me, I suspect he saw it and just thinks you faked that anger. If you did, I shall eat my pipe.
He took the pipe from his mouth and waved it about for emphasis.
Aloysia was always ambitious. Do you not think she might like the title of Empress?
Maybe if there were no Emperor.
Are you planning something? Brennus asked.
Ha! No, I am still content to wait until you have learned enough real magic to stand better than a kitten's chance in a striped cat cage against Roshan. Once he is out of the way, we can worry about taming the Emperor.
Spit, Brennus said, looking down at the chessboard.
You have me again.
Brennus tipped his king over.
Got to get that mind of yours clear. I can carry on talking and still play with all my wits. How do you expect to learn to fight a warlock if you cannot keep a chess game separate in your thoughts?
Lord Harwick began setting up the pieces again, using magic rather than his own aging fingers. The black and white armies arrayed themselves in perfect rows once more.
All right, but if I win this time, I want you to write out that lightning spell you've been promising me all week,
Brennus said. He took the white set and opened with his king's pawn.
It had best be worth the effort learning it when I already know the one from Powers of the Sky.
Brennus, my boy, you never learn the best ones from books. You might use them as a start, but there are always improvements to be made. No sorcerer worth any wits puts the best ones between bindings. Private journals, perhaps, but not those pedantic old tomes. The one I will show you will be much easier to use silently. I almost hesitate to even let you practice these aloud, Invadress. Mutter and waggle fingers in the safety of your own home for this one, but let slip nothing in Cadran. Kyrus needs to skip to the end.
Does anyone ever manage to do that?
Brennus asked.
Roughly as many sorcerers as manage a transference spell between worlds would be my guess.
Even with the afternoon sunshine, it was still cold enough for breath to steam lightly as the two opponents circled one another. The grass beneath their bare feet was still green, but was strewn with brown leaves that crunched unheeded underfoot. One of the fighters was black-skinned, glistening with sweat and stripped to the waist, revealing a lean build. His hair hung in two long braids that fell halfway down his back, dark as his skin. He watched his opponent with one good eye, his other covered by a patch. His opponent was a hair taller, thinner, fair-skinned and female, wearing nothing but loose black pants and a cloth wrap about her chest. Her jaw-length hair hung loose, blowing auburn with the breeze. She had not broken a sweat in the sparring match.
Oh, to be 23 again, Rakashi opined, huffing for breath as he watched his opponent circling him.
Hey, sparring was your idea, Soria replied. Don't blame me if you can't keep up.
She closed the gap between them, launching a series of easily dodged punches. She only hit him when he made mistakes, keeping the match as friendly as her Tejuan training allowed.
I only agreed because I have nothing better to occupy my time with while Brennus spends every day with Lord Harwick.
Yes, why is Brennus so interested in this Sicardian lord? Rakashi asked.
I guess you'd figure it out eventually anyway. He's one of us. It's Brennus's uncle. I'm keeping well clear of it, since I want him inquiring about my affairs as much as I'm sure he wants me knowing of his. Brennus's uncle is fine, I suppose, but he's a devious one. I want to get dragged in as little as possible, without leaving Brennus.
Is he covered in our bargain? Rakashi asked.
Probably not, but I still wouldn't try it, Soria replied. He's as much of a sorcerer as I've seen around Tellurak. He's got real wards, and no shields, and God only knows what kind of killing spells. He's inner circle on the other side. I've kept you out of the conversation for all this time. Don't go drawing his attention yourself.
Very well, I will keep clear of him then.
You ready to get knocked around a bit more? Soria asked.
This is certainly reminding me why we kept Tanner around all these years, despite his faults, Rakashi replied. He is as good a match as I can recall finding. At least with a half-spear in my hand, I could make a good accounting of myself against you.
Rakashi blocked a quick punch by Soria and hopped back out of the range of the kick.
Sure, until I actually hurt you. You and Tanner may have worked out some swordmaster's pact, but I have a hard time pulling punches against real weapons, Soria said.
Rakashi made a counterattack, leading with a punch, which Soria sidestepped.
and following with a kick. Soria stepped just out of the reach of the kick, caught hold of Rikashi's ankle, and dropped down to kick his plant foot out from under him. The Tikalish warrior landed heavily on his back.
"I think I have had enough for one day."
"Fine," Soria said, retrieving her tunic from one of the stone railings. The low terrace of the villa she had purchased for herself and Brannis overlooked the hedged garden where she and Rikashi practiced. "By the way, not that I mind the rescue or even the loss of those miserable crewmen I was yoked with, but what were you doing out in those woods anyway?" Rikashi stood staring a moment. Soria could only wonder at the thoughts roiling behind the calm expression that so rarely changed.
"It may surprise you, but a Blade Priest oath does not bind him to hopeless fights. Facing a single great adversary is a matter for honor, but standing against an army is a foolish death," Rikashi explained, pulling himself up to his elbows.
"Fair point, but you were in Mune, weren't you? You fled when the Kadrin army retook the city."
"Yes."
"Iridan was killed in Mune," Soria said. She watched Rikashi for signs of a reaction. "Do you know anything about that?"
"He died a warlock's death," Rikashi said. "His body was treated with respect, sent to his homeland for a proper mourning. You said nothing, but I presume it arrived."
"Did you have anything to do with it?" Soria asked.
"I was the one who made the arrangements."
"Did you kill him?" Her look promised that she would have hauled him up by his collar if he had been wearing one.
"Yes. I was the strongest warrior, chosen by fate and circumstance to face a formidable opponent who had already slain three of my comrades."
Rikashi looked her in the eye as he spoke. Her breath came quicker than it had from the exertion of the sparring. She stared down at her friend, who had at times filled the role of brother, of father, and mentor. She saw his muscles tensed, ready to defend himself if she became violent.
"Why?"
"As I said, I..."
"Why didn't you tell me?" Soria demanded.
Her hands were curled into tight fists, nails digging into her palms.
"To spare you this moment, if I could."
"It seems I could not," Rikashi said. His expression was stoic, hard to read as ever. Soria wished
she saw shame,
or regret, or anything but the same placid Rikashi. Every muscle in his limbs and torso was poised for battle, but nothing reflected in his face.
"He is dead either way. Why spread sorrow where it need not go?"
"Maybe because you owed it to me? We're friends, Rikashi. What did you think I would do, kill you for being the one responsible?"
"I am still not certain that you will not."
Rikashi stared up at her. She noticed his gaze flick momentarily over to the terrace, where his half-spear lay sheathed. Soria breathed a frustrated sigh. She walked over to the terrace, took his weapon and the rest of his clothing, and threw them down next to him.
"Iridan didn't deserve to die, but you were doing what you were born to do. I get it. They put you in his path. You were honor-bound to stand your ground."
"He was determined to prove he could take on anything," Soria said.
"I am more hurt that you hid it from me, like pretending it didn't happen could make it go away. Did you think I would never find out?"
"I had other concerns as well," Rikashi admitted. Soria's eyes widened.
"Brannis," she whispered. "You can't let him find out. He will kill you in both worlds if he knows you killed Iridan."
"You confirm my suspicion as well. He already mistrusts me. I fear he would not react as rationally as you have."
Rikashi climbed to his feet and began untangling his clothes from the pile Soria had presented him.
"Oh no, you haven't flown free quite yet. I may forgive you, but not yet," Soria said.
"What if I cleared the path between you and Brannis and Vaedrus?" Rikashi asked as he pulled on his tunic.
"You bastard! You did this for me?"
"Iridan was violent. By your own word and by all measure I have taken of him, Brannis has been unfailingly kind to you." "Yes, I did it for you."
Soria swallowed a rising lump in her throat, but she could not refute his argument.
"Did I secretly wish him dead?" "Get out of here. We can talk about this back in Vaedras. I have a party to dress for.
Dinner that night was lavish, hosted by Lord Harwick in his son's home. Brannis had gone home to change into more formal attire and retrieve Soria. By the time they returned, a number of other guests had already arrived. Minor noblemen and gentlemen from the Society of Learned Men filled Thomas Harwick's sitting room as their wives congregated in the foyer. The former smoked pipes and drank brandy. The latter sipped wine while partaking of pastry cakes and gossip. Brannis deposited Soria among the ladies, for which he received a withering glare. He shrugged it away with an amused smile and went to join Lord Harwick's peers. There was one young man in the sitting room who looked out of place. He had met the lad before, but Brannis hardly recognized Neelan Tillman, with his hair combed, the light scruff shaved from his cheeks, and a well-tailored suit wrapped around him. The suit fit him ill, in spirit if not in its shape, causing him to squirm and chafe against the stiff, starched collar and fight with unruly ruffles. Brannis nodded acknowledgement to him as he looked for his host. Soria passed the time drinking more than her share of the wine. Getting drunk enough to enjoy the company of the light-hearted, light-headed ladies was difficult, since the wine seemed to have been cut with juice. She knew she would have only found herself a different sort of board were she to intrude upon the stodgy old men in the other room. So she hung around the periphery of conversations, trying to look interested and keep from being engaged directly.
"Good evening, Lady Soria," a lyrical voice called out behind her. "Miss Abelay, how are you this fine evening?" Soria replied. She was enough of a natural actress to betray none of the antipathy she felt for the girl. Unfairly, she realized, since Abelay seemed a sweet girl, but that was almost the point. Soria had visited the girl's studio some 2 months prior in disguise. Nothing elaborate, just hair, eyes, mannerisms. As near as Soria could tell, Abelay had never drawn the connection between her and Darla Silverweave. For an artist, it seemed an unforgivable lack of observational skill.
"Oh, wonderful! Isn't this a splendid party? I'm sure it's all stale bread to you by now, but I can't get used to all this finery."
Abelay turned about as she spoke, gawking at the surroundings. It was the same manor that Abelay visited regularly, just filled with wealthy personages, extra servants, and more food and drink than usual.
"I don't suppose that I've ever gotten used to these affairs," Soria admitted. "It's the clothes, the dressing up special. Pretending that's what is important. Trying to impress everyone else while they try to impress you in return. Too often I spoil the effect by failing to act snooty enough to match my dress.
Everyone else wishes they could act normal too.
But they all cluck their tongues like it's some serious offense. Well, everyone has been very kind to me. If I've been spoiling anything, they have yet to mention it," Abelay replied.
"Of course not," Soria mused. "You are low-born, so they expect it of you. They overlook it all for the novelty."
"I am sure you are just naturally suited to these affairs," Soria replied. She gave a little nod to indicate she would be continuing along to other parts of the gathering, and managed to avoid Abelay for the remainder of the wait until the servants gathered them to the table for dinner.
"How are you holding up?"
Brannis whispered in Soria's ear as he pulled out her chair and helped her to her seat.
"I played nice with your peasant girl," Soria whispered in reply, using Cadran in case anyone overheard. It was a fringe benefit of being exotic. Her Keshi accent made it perfectly plausible for her to be speaking in a foreign language in hushed conversations at the table. It might have been considered a bit rude, but far less so than what she had actually said. The conversation improved over dinner with the mixing of the sexes. Lord Harwick in particular knew everyone, and his voice carried the length of the table, allowing Brannis and Soria to hear him from the far end where they were seated. Still, it was a dinner party. There was a limit to how interesting conversation was allowed to get. After a fine dinner of Feru boar, imported live and butchered just that morning, the servants came and refilled everyone's wine glasses. Lord Harwick rose to speak, and his guests fell silent.
"Lords and ladies, if I might have your attention for just a moment.
Lord Harwick paused for form's sake, since all eyes were already turned his way.
This gathering tonight was at the behest of my son Thomas. Lest I use up all the wind in the room first, I will allow him the chance to speak.
Thank you, father, Thomas said as he rose and Lord Harwick sat. The boyish nobleman's face was plastered with a goofy smile as he stood for a moment, looking out over the guests. Soria looked sidelong at Brannis. She knew he could not see what was coming. She took his hand under the table.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. I look out and I see friends old and new, and no finer friends could a man wish for. Thus it is before all of you as witnesses that I ask.
He turned to Abile.
Abile Tillman, would you marry me?
Abile froze, her expression blank. When the realization dawned, she said nothing, but leapt from her seat to wrap her arms about Thomas's neck. Thomas laughed as he recovered from his surprise and wrapped his own arms around her waist to keep them from overbalancing and toppling to the floor. Soria felt Brannis's hand tighten around hers. She squeezed back. She knew it was Kyrus's memories making it hard on him, but also that he had been growing to see himself and Kyrus more and more as the two sides of a coin, just the way she saw Juliana. Both sides of her had been in love with Brannis as far back as she cared to remember, but it was still new to him, and he struggled with conflicting feelings about Abile. Soria hated it.
I shall take that as a yes, then, Thomas said, still laughing.
Oh, yes, yes,
Abile gushed. There was cheering and applause. Soria released Brannis's hand and kicked him beneath the table. It took two kicks before he realized he ought to clap as well. One of Thomas's friends gave a toast to the betrothed couple, and the atmosphere of the party brightened with talk of a wedding. It was some time before it was polite for Brannis and Soria to leave, but Soria took Brannis away from the manor as soon as that time arrived.
I don't know why he felt we needed to be there for that, Soria said as they walked home.
They carried their cloaks despite the cold night air. Both had gotten drunk during the celebration, and the warmth of the alcohol kept them from noticing the weather much.
He had a point to make, Brannis said deliberately, fighting his way around a slur. You and me here. No Abile for Kyrus. No Abile for Brannis to keep until Kyrus gets home. Kyrus takes Celia, at least for now, Brannis amended quickly, fearing to anger Soria when he was too drunk to defend himself properly. We can figure out Kyrus and Juliana someday, I think.
You and me, huh? Soria said.
Yep.
I'm holding you to that, Soria said.
She slid her arm through Brannis's and squeezed tight. The bazaars of Marker's Point swarmed with bodies. Cloth of red, yellow, brown, and 100 other colors swirled in a chaotic dance without rhythm or harmony. A dozen languages were shouted, one louder than the next, as hawkers sought to drown out their competitors and merchants and buyers haggled over the din. A horse and wagon cleared a small space as folk kept a wary distance from hoof and wheel. A man with a wicker basket of bread rolls would routinely use it as a ram to batter his way through the throngs. The only way to reliably navigate the city without harassment was to appear dangerous. Hulking bodies and openly carried weapons hinted at the possibility of violence.
A sheathed sword and a pistol tucked into the front of a pair of trousers were a good way to keep from being bothered.
Tanner perused the stalls of the marketplace at leisure. The shielding spell he cast each morning was still offering its protection. He browsed idly, not much interested in purchasing anything. It was a break from his routine, from the incessant wobbling of the decks beneath his feet. The bazaar was a potpourri of smells that were never meant to be mixed. Musky spices, cooked meats, sawdust, leather, perfumes, and the perspiring bodies of men and women from 100 different cultures. It was still a better odor than the cloying stink of 40 pirates, sweating, drinking, and pissing within the close confines of the fair trader's hull.
How much for the flagon? Tanner inquired on a whim.
He had taken a sudden fancy to a pewter vessel hanging amid a host of others similar to it. If he ever managed to rejoin his companions,
It would make a fine gift for Zelisan.
200 fons, the peddler replied with a thick Keshi accent.
Tanner frowned, checking the heft of his coin purse and trying to remember its contents.
I haven't got any fons. Can you change a trade bar?
He pulled one of the finger-sized square bars of gold from his purse and held it up for the merchant's inspection.
Ah, go find a money changer. I not have that much coin in whole cart. You buy everything, I take trade bar, else you come back with fun.
Tanner gave the peddler's cart a dismissive look and shoved the trade bar back into his coin purse. He made use of one of the better Keshi curse words Soria had taught him as he turned to leave, and received a long string of Keshi in return, none of which he understood. As he continued through the endless markets, he felt a tingling in the back of his neck. He had developed an instinct from his years working in the roughest parts of cities. He was being followed. The same men, seen too many times, first at the bootblack stall, then at the peddler with the spitted sausages, and again as he left the pewtersmith. He had not gotten a good look yet to confirm it, but he trusted the instincts that had kept him alive over the years. A coinblade's life was best suited to someone paranoid. Ducking into a storefront, he purchased a wide-brimmed hat. Though he had not stopped to check his reflection, he knew he must look ridiculous in it. That was the point. He headed back down the street he had been on, moving hastily through the crowd and looking all about him as he went. When he saw what he was searching for, he would know it. If he was indeed being followed, then his pursuers could not possibly have lost track of him. He kept up his pace. The streets of Marker's Point ran miles along the crescent moon shape of the city. Up ahead, Tanner saw a girl, a young slip of a thing, carrying a tall wicker basket balanced on her head. If you included the basket, she was nearly his height. He quickened his pace to catch up with her and gently slipped the hat from his head and onto the top of the basket she carried. The hat and Tanner parted ways at the next cross street.
"Well, Marker's Point, it has been fun yet again," Tanner whispered as a small knot of unsavory ruffians rushed by to pursue the hat.
Denric's men had been looking for him.
Tanner sighed.
On the upside, even had those pirates caught him, all they were likely to do was fetch him on the captain's behalf. The downside was that it likely meant the end of shore leave. Tanner saw no reason to find the crewmen and remedy the misunderstanding. They would find their own way back to the fair trader. He headed back to the ship himself, making no great haste about it, feeling the ground pressing up against his feet as he walked and savoring the uniformity, the predictability of it. He was a swordsman, trained to keep his movements balanced, so finding his sea legs never caused much trouble, but he found that he missed the land the more time he spent away from it. Upon his arrival back at the fair trader's berth, he greeted Captain Zane.
"You are looking for me?"
Tanner had found it interesting that the captain almost never left the ship, no matter the time they spent in port.
He had seen the man with soil beneath his feet, perhaps twice.
"Indeed I was," Captain Zane replied, his gaze wandering past Tanner. It seemed that the captain had expected Tanner to have been brought to him, not to have come of his own accord.
"Come in and shut the door behind you. Been a while since we had ourselves one of these nice little talks. What's sticking in your craw?" Tanner asked, pulling up a chair and tipping back in it, putting his boots up on the table.
"I assume you heard about Relith?"
"Aye, but I am neither here to beg for terms of surrender, nor did I invite you here to gloat about it," Captain Zane replied. He sat down across the table from Tanner, keeping clear of the rudely placed feet.
"Figured that much. What's left to surrender at this point unless you can convince Safshan and Gelk and whatever little city-states signed on with your alliance to throw down their weapons?
I have spent a great deal of time and coin trying to locate the boy your friends kidnapped.
I told you already. They stopped telling me what was going on with that. They might tell me if I had something from you to barter, but I don't see why you'd be any more willing to deal now," Tanner reasoned.
"No, indeed. I believe you that they no longer confide in you. You are stuck here as both my liaison and my keeper. I cannot tell you how many times I have been within a blade's edge of having you tossed overboard.
but the voice in my head keeps whispering that something will come up, that I will find a use for you. Aw, that's sweet of you. If you don't mind me saying, I'm just as glad you didn't try to feed me to the sharks. As many of your men as I'd run through, I probably couldn't take on the whole crew. We both know that. And hey, it's not my fault you and Kairos can't come to terms on ending the war. Your offer was a bit steep. It stands, though. If he gives me the warlock's head, we will have some grounds to ending the war and returning the staff of Galen to Cadrin, Captain Zane said. Uh-huh. Kairos wants to face Roshan as much as you do. That is to say, you'd rather it be him. He'd rather it was you. And neither of you likes your own odds. Ever think of maybe trusting Kairos and handing him the staff? See if that's enough to give him the leg up on Roshan. Not if the sea froze solid. Just figured I'd ask. No, Mr. Tanner. I have had another revelation. All this coin and effort I spend, for a boy I have never met. For all that he is as like to Anzik as I am to Jinzan, he is still my son, in some fashion. Whether he was born by some whore I bedded years ago, or is no relation to me in this world, I will continue my search for him, with or without your help. Fair enough, Cap'n, Tanner agreed. My revelation was this. What is your price, Mr. Tanner? My price for what? Tanner asked, growing suspicious. For bringing Anzik out of Cadrin, for saving my other son from your friends. How much will it take to bribe you to do the right thing? Tanner furrowed his brow and smiled. Let me think on it.